Also, her case wasn't published until several years after it occurred. And its author, Dr. Michael Sabom, is a born-again Christian who had been working for decades to substantiate the otherworldly significance of the NDE. The possibility that experimenter bias, witness tampering, however unconscious, and false memories intruded into this best of all recorded cases is painfully obvious. The latest NDE to receive wide acclaim was featured on the cover of Newsweek magazine. Quote, "Heaven is Real, a Doctor's Experience of the Afterlife." The great novelty of this case is that its subject, Eben Alexander, is a neurosurgeon who we might presume is competent to judge the scientific significance of his experience. Alexander also wrote a book, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, which became an instant bestseller. As it happens, it displaced one of the best-selling books of the past decade, Heaven is for Real, yet another account of the afterlife, based on the near-death adventures of a 4-year-old son of a minister. Unsurprisingly, the two books offer incompatible views of what awaits us beyond the prison of the brain. Colorful as his account is, Alexander neglects to tell us that Jesus rides a rainbow-colored horse, or that the souls of dead children must still do homework in heaven. At the time of this writing, Alexander's book is ranked number 1 on the New York Times paperback bestseller list, and it has been on the list for 56 weeks. The psychologist Raymond Moody, who coined the phrase near-death experience, called Alexander's account, quote, "the most astounding I have heard in more than 4 decades of studying this phenomenon. He is living proof of an afterlife." Well then, prepare to be astounded. Once upon a time, a neurosurgeon named Eben Alexander contracted a bad case of bacterial meningitis and fell into a coma. While immobile in his hospital bed, he experienced visions of such intense beauty that they changed everything, not just for him, but for all of us, and for science as a whole. According to Alexander, his experience proves that consciousness is independent of the brain, that death is an illusion, and that heaven exists, complete with the usual angels, clouds, and departed relatives, but also butterflies and beautiful girls in peasant dress. Our current understanding of the mind, quote, "now lies broken at our feet, for, as Alexander declares, what happened to me destroyed it, and I intend to spend the rest of my life investigating the true nature of consciousness and making the fact that we are more, much more than our physical brains as clear as I can, both to my fellow scientists and to people at large." It should be clear from the preceding chapters that unlike many scientists and philosophers, I remain agnostic on the question of how consciousness is related to the physical world. There are good reasons to believe that it is an emergent property of brain activity, just as the rest of the human mind is. But we know nothing about how such a miracle of emergence might occur. And if consciousness were irreducible, or even separable from the brain in a way that would give comfort to St. Augustine, my worldview would not be overturned. I know that we do not understand consciousness, and nothing that I think I know about the cosmos, or about the patent falsity of most religious beliefs, requires that I deny this. So although I am an atheist who can be expected to be critical of religious dogma, I'm not reflexively hostile to claims of the sort Alexander has made. In principle, my mind is open. It really is. However, almost nothing about Alexander's account withstands scrutiny. And this is especially insidious, given that he claims to be a scientist. Many of his errors are glaring but immaterial. In his book, for instance, he understates the estimated number of neurons in the human brain by a factor of 10. Others are utterly damning to his case. Whatever his qualifications on paper, Alexander's evangelizing about his experience in coma is so devoid of intellectual sobriety, to say nothing of rigor, that I would see no reason to engage with it if it were not for the fact that his book has been read and believed by millions of people. One of the greatest obstacles I see to our fashioning a rational approach to spirituality is to have religious superstition and self-deception masquerade as science. Hence, it is worth considering Alexander's case in detail. First, there are some troubling signs that the good doctor is just another casualty of American-style Christianity. For though he claims to have been a non-believer before his adventures in coma, he offers the following self-portrait. "Although I considered myself a faithful Christian, I was so more in name than in actual belief. I didn't begrudge those who wanted to believe that Jesus was simply more than a good man who suffered at the hands of the world. I sympathized deeply with those who wanted to believe that there was a God somewhere out there who loved us unconditionally. In fact, I envied such people the security that those beliefs no doubt provided. But as a scientist, I simply knew better than to believe them myself." What it means to be a faithful Christian without actual belief is not spelled out. but few non-believers will be surprised that our hero's scientific skepticism proves no match for his religious conditioning. Most of us have been around this block often enough to know that many, quote, former atheists, like Francis Collins, spent so long on the brink of faith and yearned for its emotional consolations with such vampiric intensity that the slightest breeze could send them hurtling into the abyss. For Collins, you may recall, all it took to establish the divinity of Jesus and the coming resurrection of the dead was the sight of a frozen waterfall. As we will see, Alexander seems to have required a ride on a psychedelic butterfly. In either case, it's not the perception of beauty we should begrudge, but the utter absence of intellectual seriousness with which the author interprets it. Everything in Alexander's account rests on his repeated and unwarranted assertion that his visions of heaven occurred while his cerebral cortex was, quote, shut down, inactivated, completely shut down, totally offline, and stunned to complete inactivity. He claims that the cessation of cortical activity was, quote, clear from the severity and duration of my meningitis and from the global cortical involvement documented by CT scans and neurological examinations. To his editors, this presumably sounded like science. Unfortunately, the evidence Alexander offers, in the article, in a subsequent response to my public criticism of it, in his book, and in multiple interviews, suggests that he doesn't understand what would constitute compelling evidence for his central claim of cortical inactivity. The proof he offers is either fallacious, CT scans do not measure brain activity, or irrelevant. It does not matter, even slightly, that his form of meningitis was, quote, astronomically rare. And no combination of fallacy and irrelevancy adds up to sound science. Alexander makes no reference to functional data that might have been acquired by fMRI, PET, or EEG. Nor does he seem to realize that this is the sort of evidence necessary to support his case. The impediment to taking Alexander's claim seriously can be simply stated. There is no reason to believe that his cerebral cortex was inactive at the time he had his experience of the afterlife. The fact that Alexander thinks he has demonstrated otherwise, by continually emphasizing how sick he was, the infrequency of cases of E. coli meningitis, and the ugliness of his initial CT scan, suggests a deliberate disregard for the most plausible interpretation of his experience. Apparently, Alexander's cortex is functioning now. He has, after all, written a book. So whatever structural damage appeared on CT could not have been, quote, global. Otherwise, he would be making the quite crazy claim that his entire cortex was destroyed and then grew back. Coma is not associated with the complete cessation of cortical activity in any case. In fact, neuroimaging studies suggest that comatose patients, like patients under general anesthesia, have 50 to 70% of the normal level of cortical activity. And to my knowledge, almost no one thinks that consciousness is purely a matter of what happens in the cortex. Why doesn't Alexander know these things? He is, after all, a neurosurgeon, who now claims to be upending the scientific worldview on the basis of the fact that his cortex was totally quiescent at the precise moment he was enjoying the best day of his life in the company of angels. Even if his entire cortex did truly shut down, again, an incredible claim, how can he know that his visions didn't occur in the minutes and hours after its functions returned? The very fact that Alexander remembers his NDE suggests that the cortical and subcortical structures necessary for memory formation were active at the time. How else could he recall the experience? Not only does Alexander appear ignorant of the relevant science, he doesn't realize how many people have experienced visions similar to his while under the influence of psychedelics such as DMT or anesthetics such as ketamine. In fact, he has said that any suggestion of similarity between the effect of such compounds on the brain and his experience is, quote, not even in the right ballpark. But here is Alexander's description of the afterlife, as told in an interview. I was a speck on a beautiful butterfly wing, millions of other butterflies around us. We were flying through blooming flowers, blossoms on trees, and they were all coming out as we flew through them. There were waterfalls, pools of water, indescribable colors. And above there were these arcs of silver and gold light and beautiful hymns coming down from them. Indescribably gorgeous hymns. I later came to call them angels, those arcs of light in the sky. I think that word is probably fairly accurate. Then we went out of this universe. I remember just seeing everything receding, and initially I felt as if my awareness was in an infinite black void. It was very comforting, but I could feel the extent of the infinity, and that it was, as you would expect, impossible to put into words. I was there with that divine presence. There was not anything that I could visibly see and describe. and with a brilliant orb of light. They said that there were many things that they would show me, and they continued to do that. In fact, the whole higher-dimensional multiverse was this incredibly complex, corrugated ball, and all these lessons were coming into me about it. Part of the lessons involved becoming all that I was being shown. It was indescribable. Not even in the right ballpark? His experience sounds so much like a DMT trip that we are not only in the right ballpark, we are talking about the stitching on the same ball. Everything that Alexander describes about his experience, including the parts I have left out, has been reported by DMT users. The similarity is uncanny. Here's how Terence McKenna described the prototypical DMT trance. Under the influence of DMT, the world becomes an Arabian labyrinth, a palace, a more than possible Martian jewel, vast with motifs that flood the gaping mind with complex and wordless awe. Color and the sense of a reality-unlocking secret nearby pervade the experience. There's a sense of other times, and of one's own infancy, and of wonder, wonder, and more wonder. It is an audience with the alien nuncio. In the midst of this experience, apparently at the end of human history, guarding gates that seem surely to open onto the howling maelstrom of the unspeakable emptiness between the stars, is the Aeon. The Aeon, as Heraclitus presciently observed, is a child at play with colored balls. Many diminutive beings are present there. The Tykes, the self-transforming machine elves of hyperspace. Are they children destined to be father to the man? One has the impression of entering into an ecology of souls that lies beyond the portals of what we naively call death. I do not know. Are they the synesthetic embodiment of ourselves as the other, or of the other as ourselves? Are they the elves lost to us since the fading magic light of childhood? Here is a tremendum barely to be told, an epiphany beyond our wildest dreams. Here is the realm of that which is stranger than we can suppose. Here is the mystery, alive, unscathed, still as new for us as when our ancestors lived it 15,000 summers ago. The tryptamine entities offer the gift of new language. They sing in pearly voices that rain down as colored petals and flow through the air like hot metal to become toys and such gifts as gods would give their children. The sense of emotional connection is terrifying and intense. The mysteries revealed are real, and if ever fully told, will leave no stone standing upon another in this small world we have gone so ill in. This is not the mercurial world of the UFO, to be invoked from lonely hilltops. This is not the siren song of lost Atlantis, wailing through the trailer courts of crack-crazed America. DMT is not one of our irrational illusions. I believe that what we experience in the presence of DMT is real news. It is a nearby dimension, frightening, transformative, and beyond our powers to imagine, and yet to be explored in the usual way. We must send fearless experts, whatever that may come to mean, to explore and to report on what they find. Alexander believes that his brain could not have produced his visions because they were too intense, too hyper-real, too beautiful, too interactive, and too drenched in significance for a brain to conjure. He also thinks that his visions could not have arisen in the minutes or hours during which his cortex, which surely never went off, switched back on. But he has simply ignored what people with working brains experience under the influence of psychedelics. And he does not appear to know that visions of the sort that McKenna describes, although they may seem to last for ages, require only a brief span of biological time. Unlike LSD and other long-acting psychedelics, DMT alters consciousness for only a few minutes. Alexander would have had more than enough time to experience a visionary ecstasy as he was coming out of his coma, whether or not his cortex was rebooting. Alexander knows that DMT already exists in the brain as a neurotransmitter. Did his brain experience a surge of DMT release during his coma? In his book, he discounts this possibility by reiterating the unfounded claim upon which his entire account rests. DMT would require a functioning cortex upon which to act, whereas his cortex, quote, wasn't available to be affected. Similar experiences can be had with ketamine, a surgical anesthetic that is occasionally used to protect a traumatized brain. Did Alexander by any chance receive ketamine while in the hospital? Did he have some other anesthetic that might produce a similar spectrum of effects at low doses? Would he even think it relevant if he had? His assertion that a psychedelic like DMT, or an anesthetic like ketamine could not, quote, explain the kind of clarity, the rich interactivity, the layer upon layer of understanding he experienced, is perhaps the most amazing thing he has said since returning from heaven. Such compounds are universally understood to do the job. And most scientists believe that the reliable effects of psychedelics indicate that the brain is at the very least involved in the production of visionary states of the sort that Alexander is talking about. The knowledge of the afterlife that Alexander claims to possess also depends upon some extraordinarily dubious methods of verification. While in his coma, he saw a beautiful girl riding beside him on the wing of a butterfly. We learn in his book that he developed his recollection of this experience over a period of months, writing, thinking about it, and mining it for new details. It would be hard to imagine a better way to engineer a distortion of memory. Alexander also tells us that he had a biological sister he never met, who died some years before his coma. Seeing her picture for the first time after his recovery, he judged this woman to be the girl who had joined him for the butterfly ride. He sought further confirmation of this by speaking with his biological family, from whom he learned that his dead sister had indeed always been, quote, very loving. QED. As I've said throughout this book, I have spent much of my life studying and seeking experiences of the kind that Alexander describes. I haven't contracted meningitis, thankfully, nor have I had an NDE, but I have experienced many of the phenomena that often lead people to believe in the supernatural. For instance, I once had an opportunity to study with the great Tibetan Lama Dingo Kensi Rinpoche in Nepal. Before making the trip, I had a dream in which he seemed to give me teachings about the nature of the mind. The dream struck me as interesting for two reasons. The teachings I received were novel, useful, and convergent with what I later understood to be true. And I had never met Kensi Rinpoche, nor was I aware of having seen a photograph of him. This preceded my access to the internet by at least 5 years, so the belief that I had never seen his picture was more plausible than it would be now. I also recall that I had no easy way of finding a picture of him for the sake of comparison. But because I was about to meet the man himself, it seemed that I would be able to confirm whether he had really been in my dream. First, the teachings. The Lama in my dream began by asking who I was. I responded by telling him my name. Apparently, this wasn't the answer he was looking for. "Who are you?" he said again. He was now staring fixedly into my eyes and pointing at my face with an outstretched finger. I did not know what to say. "Who are you?" he said again, continuing to point. "Who are you?" he said a final time. But here he suddenly shifted his gaze and pointing finger, as though he were now addressing someone just to my left. The effect was quite startling, because I knew, insofar as one can be said to know anything in a dream, that we were alone. The Lama was pointing to someone who wasn't there, and I suddenly noticed what I would later understand to be an important truth about the nature of the mind. Subjectively speaking, there's only consciousness and its contents. There's no inner self who is conscious. The sense of looking over one's own shoulder, as it were, is an illusion. The Lama in my dream seemed to dissect this very feeling of being a self, and for a brief moment removed it from my mind. I awoke convinced that I had glimpsed something quite profound. After traveling to Nepal and encountering the arresting figure of Kensi Rinpoche instructing hundreds of monks from atop a brocade throne, I was struck by the sense that he really did resemble the man in my dream. Even more apparent, however, was the fact that I couldn't know whether this impression was veridical. No doubt it would have been more fun to believe that something magical had occurred and that I had been singled out for some sort of transpersonal initiation. But the allure of this belief suggested only that the bar for proof should be raised rather than lowered. And even though I had no formal scientific training at that point, I knew that human memory is unreliable under conditions of this kind. How much stock could I put in the feeling of familiarity? Was I accurately recalling the face of a man I had met in a dream, or was I engaged in a creative reconstruction of it? If nothing else, the experience of déjà vu proves that one's sense of having experienced something previously can jump the tracks of genuine recollection. My travels in spiritual circles also brought me into contact with many people who seemed all too eager to deceive themselves about experiences of this kind, and I did not wish to emulate them. Given these considerations, I did not believe that Kensi Rinpoche had really appeared in my dream, and I certainly would never have been tempted to use this experience as conclusive proof of the supernatural. I invite you to compare this attitude to the one that Dr. Eben Alexander will most likely exhibit before crowds of credulous people for the rest of his life. The structure of our experiences was similar. We were each given an opportunity to compare a face remembered from a dream or vision with a person or photo in the physical world. I realized that the task was hopeless. Alexander believes that he has made the greatest discovery in the history of science. Again, nothing can be said against Alexander's experience, and such ecstasies do tell us something about how good a human mind can feel. The problem is that the conclusions Alexander has drawn from his experience, as a scientist, he continually reminds us, are based on flagrant errors in reasoning and misunderstandings of the relevant science. The enthusiastic reception Alexander has enjoyed also suggests a general confusion about the nature of scientific authority. Much of the criticism I've received for dismissing his account focuses on what appear to be his impeccable scientific credentials. However, when debating the validity of evidence and arguments, the point is never that one person's credentials trump another's. Credentials merely offer a rough indication of what a person is likely to know, or should know. If Alexander were drawing reasonable scientific conclusions from his experience, he wouldn't need to be a neuroscientist to be taken seriously. He could be a philosopher or a coal miner. But he simply isn't thinking like a scientist, and so not even a string of Nobel Prizes would shield him from criticism. Such is the perennial problem with reports of this kind. Some people are so desperate to interpret the NDE as proof of an afterlife that even those whom one would expect to have a strong commitment to scientific reasoning toss their better judgment out the window. The truth is that whatever happens after death, it is possible to justify a life of spiritual practice and self-transcendence without pretending to know things we do not know. The spiritual uses of pharmacology. Everything we do is for the purpose of altering consciousness. We form friendships so that we can feel love and avoid loneliness. We eat specific foods to enjoy their fleeting presence on our tongues. We read for the pleasure of thinking another person's thoughts. Every waking moment, and even in our dreams, we struggle to direct the flow of sensation, emotion, and cognition towards states of consciousness that we value. Drugs are another means toward this end. Some are illegal, some are stigmatized, some are dangerous, though perversely these categories only partially intersect. Some drugs of extraordinary power and utility, such as psilocybin, the active compound in magic mushrooms, and lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD, pose no apparent risk of addiction and are physically well tolerated, and yet one can be sent to prison for their use. Whereas drugs such as tobacco and alcohol, which have ruined countless lives, are enjoyed ad libitum in almost every society on earth. There are other points on this continuum. MDMA, or ecstasy, has remarkable therapeutic potential, but it is also susceptible to abuse, and some evidence suggests that it can be neurotoxic. One of the great responsibilities we have, as a society, is to educate ourselves, along with the next generation, about which substances are worth ingesting and for what purpose, and which are not. The problem, however, is that we refer to all these biologically active materials by a single term, drugs, making it nearly impossible to have an intelligent discussion about the psychological, medical, ethical, and legal issues surrounding their use. The poverty of our language has been only slightly eased by the introduction of the term psychedelics to differentiate certain visionary compounds, which can produce extraordinary insights, from narcotics and other classic agents of stupefaction and abuse. However, we should not be too quick to feel nostalgia for the counterculture of the 1960s. Yes, crucial breakthroughs were made, socially and psychologically, and drugs were central to the process. But one need only read accounts of the time, such as Joan Didion's Slouching Towards Bethlehem, to see the problem with a society bent upon rapture at any cost. For every insight of lasting value produced by drugs, there was an army of zombies with flowers in their hair shuffling toward failure and regret. Turning on, tuning in, and dropping out is wise, or even benign, only if you can then drop into a mode of life that makes ethical and material sense, and doesn't leave your children wandering in traffic. Drug abuse and addiction are very real problems, the remedy for which is education and medical treatment, not incarceration. In fact, the most abused drugs in the United States now appear to be oxycodone and other prescription painkillers. Should these medicines be made illegal? Of course not. But people need to be informed about their hazards, and addicts need treatment. And all drugs, including alcohol, cigarettes, and aspirin, must be kept out of the hands of children. I discuss issues of drug policy in some detail in my first book, The End of Faith, and my thinking on the subject has not changed. The war on drugs has been lost and should never have been waged. I can think of no right more fundamental than the right to peacefully steward the contents of one's own consciousness. The fact that we pointlessly ruin the lives of nonviolent drug users by incarcerating them at enormous expense constitutes one of the great moral failures of our time. And the fact that we make room for them in our prisons by paroling murderers, rapists, and child molesters makes one wonder whether civilization isn't simply doomed. I have two daughters who will one day take drugs. Of course, I will do everything in my power to see that they choose their drugs wisely, but a life lived entirely without drugs is neither foreseeable nor, I think, desirable. I hope they someday enjoy a morning cup of tea or coffee as much as I do. If they drink alcohol as adults, as they probably will, I will encourage them to do it safely. If they choose to smoke marijuana, I will urge moderation. Tobacco should be shunned, and I will do everything within the bounds of decent parenting to steer them away from it. Needless to say, if I knew that either of my daughters would eventually develop a fondness for methamphetamine or heroin, I might never sleep again. But if they don't try a psychedelic like psilocybin or LSD at least once in their adult lives, I will wonder whether they had missed one of the most important rites of passage a human being can experience. This is not to say that everyone should take psychedelics. As I will make clear in a moment, these drugs pose certain dangers. Undoubtedly, some people cannot afford to give the anchor of sanity even the slightest tug. It has been many years since I took psychedelics myself, and my abstinence is born of a healthy respect for the risks involved. However, there was a period in my early 20s when I found psilocybin and LSD to be indispensable tools, and some of the most important hours of my life were spent under their influence. Without them, I might never have discovered that there was an inner landscape of mind worth exploring. There's no getting around the role of luck here. If you are lucky, and you take the right drug, you will know what it is to be enlightened, or at least close enough to persuade you that enlightenment is possible. If you are unlucky, you will know what it is to be clinically insane. While I do not recommend the latter experience, it does increase one's respect for the tenuous condition of sanity, as well as one's compassion for people who suffer from mental illness. Human beings have ingested plant-based psychedelics for millennia, but scientific research on these compounds did not begin until the 1950s. By 1965, 1,000 studies had been published, primarily on psilocybin and LSD, many of which attested to the usefulness of psychedelics in the treatment of clinical depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, alcohol addiction, and the pain and anxiety associated with terminal cancer. Within a few years, however, this entire field of research was abolished, in an effort to stem the spread of these drugs among the public. After a hiatus that lasted an entire generation, scientific research on the pharmacology and therapeutic value of psychedelics has quietly resumed. Psychedelics such as psilocybin, LSD, DMT, and mescaline all powerfully alter cognition, perception, and mood. Most seem to exert their influence through the serotonin system in the brain, primarily by binding to 5-HT2A receptors, though several have affinity for other receptors as well, leading to increased activity in the prefrontal cortex. Although the prefrontal cortex in turn modulates subcortical dopamine production, and certain of these compounds, such as LSD, bind directly to dopamine receptors, the effect of psychedelics appears to take place largely outside of dopamine pathways, which could explain why these drugs are not habit-forming. The efficacy of psychedelics might seem to establish the material basis of mental and spiritual life beyond any doubt, for the introduction of these substances into the brain is the obvious cause of any numinous apocalypse that follows. It is possible, however, if not actually plausible, to seize this evidence from the other end and argue, as Aldous Huxley did in his classic The Doors of Perception, that the primary function of the brain may be eliminative. Its purpose may be to prevent a transpersonal dimension of mind from flooding consciousness, thereby allowing apes like ourselves to make their way in the world without being dazzled at every step by visionary phenomena that are irrelevant to their physical survival. Huxley thought of the brain as a kind of, quote, reducing valve for mind at large. In fact, the idea that the brain is a filter rather than the origin of mind goes back at least as far as Henri Bergson and William James. In Huxley's view, this would explain the efficacy of psychedelics. They may simply be a material means of opening the tap. Huxley was operating under the assumption that psychedelics decrease brain activity. Some recent data have lent support to this view. For instance, a neuroimaging study of psilocybin suggests that the drug primarily reduces activity in the anterior cingulate cortex, a region involved in a wide variety of tasks related to self-monitoring. However, other studies have found that psychedelics increase activity throughout the brain. Whatever the case, the action of these drugs does not rule out dualism or the existence of realms of mind beyond the brain. But then nothing does. That is one of the problems with views of this kind. They appear to be unfalsifiable. Physicalism, by contrast, could be easily falsified. If science ever established the existence of ghosts or reincarnation or any other phenomenon that placed the human mind in whole or in part outside the brain, physicalism would be dead. The fact that dualists can never say what might count as evidence against their views makes this ancient philosophical position very difficult to distinguish from religious faith. We have reason to be skeptical of the brain as barrier thesis. If the brain were merely a filter on the mind, damaging it should increase cognition. In fact, strategically damaging the brain should be the most reliable method of spiritual practice available to anyone. In almost every case, loss of brain should yield more mind. But that is not how the mind works. Some people try to get around this by suggesting that the brain may function more like a radio, a receiver of conscious states, rather than a barrier to them. At first glance, this would appear to account for the deleterious effects of neurological injury and disease, for if one smashes a radio with a hammer, it will no longer function properly. There's a problem with this metaphor, however. Those who employ it invariably forget that we are the music, not the radio. If the brain were nothing more than a receiver of conscious states, it should be impossible to diminish a person's experience of the cosmos by damaging her brain. She might seem unconscious from the outside, like a broken radio, but subjectively speaking, the music would play on. Specific reductions in brain activity might benefit people in certain ways, unmasking memories, or abilities that are being actively inhibited by the regions in question. But there's no reason to think that the pervasive destruction of the central nervous system would leave the mind unaffected, much less improved. Medications that reduce anxiety generally work by increasing the effect of the inhibitory neurotransmitter GABA, thereby diminishing neuronal activity in various parts of the brain. But the fact that dampening arousal in this way can make people feel better does not suggest that they would feel better still if they were drugged into a coma. Similarly, it would be unsurprising if psilocybin reduced brain activity in areas responsible for self-monitoring, because that might in part account for the experiences that are often associated with the drug. This does not give us any reason to believe that turning off the brain entirely would yield an increased awareness of spiritual realities. However, the brain does exclude an extraordinary amount of information from consciousness. And like many who have taken psychedelics, I can attest that these compounds throw open the gates. Positing the existence of a mind at large is more tempting in some states of consciousness than in others. But these drugs can also produce mental states that are best viewed as forms of psychosis. As a general matter, I believe we should be very slow to draw conclusions about the nature of the cosmos on the basis of inner experiences, no matter how profound they may seem. One thing is certain. The mind is vaster and more fluid than our ordinary waking consciousness suggests, and it is simply impossible to communicate the profundity, or seeming profundity, of psychedelic states to those who have never experienced them. Indeed, it is even difficult to remind oneself of the power of these states once they have passed. Many people wonder about the difference between meditation and other contemplative practices and psychedelics. Are these drugs a form of cheating, or are they the only means of authentic awakening? They are neither. All psychoactive drugs modulate the existing neurochemistry of the brain, either by mimicking specific neurotransmitters or by causing the neurotransmitters themselves to be more or less active. Everything that one can experience on a drug is, at some level, an expression of the brain's potential. Hence, whatever one has seen or felt after ingesting LSD is likely to have been seen or felt by someone, somewhere, without it. However, it cannot be denied that psychedelics are a uniquely potent means of altering consciousness. Teach a person to meditate, pray, chant, or do yoga, and there is no guarantee that anything will happen. Depending upon his aptitude or interest, the only reward for his efforts may be boredom and a sore back. If, however, a person ingests 100 micrograms of LSD, what happens next will depend on a variety of factors. But there's no question that something will happen, and boredom is simply not in the cards. Within the hour, the significance of his existence will bear down upon him like an avalanche. As the late Terence McKenna never tired of pointing out, this guarantee of profound effect, for better or worse, is what separates psychedelics from every other method of spiritual inquiry. Ingesting a powerful dose of a psychedelic drug is like strapping oneself to a rocket without a guidance system. One might wind up somewhere worth going, and depending on the compound and one's, quote, set and setting, certain trajectories are more likely than others. But however methodically one prepares for the voyage, one can still be hurled into states of mind so painful and confusing as to be indistinguishable from psychosis. Hence the terms psychotomimetic and psychotogenic are occasionally applied to these drugs. I have visited both extremes on the psychedelic continuum. The positive experiences were more sublime than I could have ever imagined, or than I can now faithfully recall. These chemicals disclose layers of beauty that art is powerless to capture, and for which the beauty of nature is itself a mere simulacrum. It is one thing to be awestruck by the sight of a giant redwood, and amazed at the details of its history and underlying biology. It is quite another to spend an apparent eternity in egoless communion with it. Positive psychedelic experiences often reveal how wondrously at ease in the universe a human being can be. And for most of us, normal waking consciousness does not offer so much as a glimmer of these deeper possibilities. People generally come away from such experiences with a sense that conventional states of consciousness obscure and truncate sacred insights and emotions. If the patriarchs and matriarchs of the world's religions experienced such states of mind, many of their claims about the nature of reality would make subjective sense. A beatific vision does not tell us anything about the birth of the cosmos, but it does reveal how utterly transfigured a mind can be by a full collision with the present moment. However, as the peaks are high, the valleys are deep. My bad trips were without question the most harrowing hours I have ever endured, and they make the notion of hell, as a metaphor, if not an actual destination, seem perfectly apt. If nothing else, these excruciating experiences can become a source of compassion. I think it may be impossible to imagine what it is like to suffer from mental illness without having briefly touched its shores. At both ends of the continuum, time dilates in ways that cannot be described, apart from merely observing that these experiences can seem eternal. I have spent hours, both good and bad, in which any understanding that I had ingested a drug was lost, and all memories of my past along with it. Immersion in the present moment to this degree is synonymous with the feeling that one has always been and will always be in precisely this condition. Depending on the character of one's experience at that point, notions of salvation or damnation may well apply. Blake's line about beholding eternity in an hour neither promises nor threatens too much. In the beginning, my experiences with psilocybin and LSD were so positive that I did not see how a bad trip could be possible. Notions of set and setting, admittedly vague, seemed sufficient to account for my good luck. My mental set was exactly as it needed to be. I was a spiritually serious investigator of my own mind, and my setting was generally one of either natural beauty or secure solitude. I cannot account for why my adventures with psychedelics were uniformly pleasant until they weren't, but once the doors to hell opened, they appeared to be left permanently ajar. Thereafter, whether or not a trip was good in the aggregate, it generally entailed some excruciating detour on the path to sublimity. Have you ever traveled beyond all mere metaphors to the mountain of shame and stayed for 1,000 years? I do not recommend it. On my first trip to Nepal, I took a rowboat out on Fuwa Lake in Pokhara, which offers a stunning view of the Annapurna Range. It was early morning, and I was alone. As the sun rose over the water, I ingested 400 micrograms of LSD. I was 20 years old and had taken the drug at least 10 times previously. What could go wrong? Everything, as it turns out. Well, not everything. I didn't drown. I had a vague memory of drifting ashore and being surrounded by a group of Nepali soldiers. After watching me for a while as I ogled them over the gunwale like a lunatic, they seemed to be on the verge of deciding what to do with me. Some polite words of Esperanto and a few mad oar strokes, and I was offshore and into oblivion. I suppose that could have ended differently. But soon there was no lake or mountains or boat, and if I had fallen into the water, I am pretty sure there would have been no one to swim. For the next several hours, my mind became a perfect instrument of self-torture. All that remained was a continuous shattering and terror, for which I have no words. An encounter like that takes something out of you. Even if LSD and similar drugs are biologically safe, they have the potential to produce extremely unpleasant and destabilizing experiences. I believe I was positively affected by my good trips and negatively affected by the bad ones for weeks and months. Meditation can open the mind to a similar range of conscious states, but far less haphazardly. If LSD is like being strapped to a rocket, learning to meditate is like gently raising a sail. Yes, it is possible, even with guidance, to wind up someplace terrifying, and some people probably shouldn't spend long periods in intensive practice. But the general effect of meditation training is of settling ever more fully into one's own skin, and suffering less there. As I discussed in The End of Faith, I view most psychedelic experiences as potentially misleading. Psychedelics do not guarantee wisdom, or a clear recognition of the selfless nature of consciousness. They merely guarantee that the contents of consciousness will change. Such visionary experiences, considered in their totality, appear to me to be ethically neutral. Therefore, it seems that psychedelic ecstasies must be steered toward our personal and collective well-being by some other principle. As Daniel Pinchbeck pointed out in his highly entertaining book, Breaking Open the Head, the fact that both the Mayans and the Aztecs used psychedelics, while being enthusiastic practitioners of human sacrifice, makes any idealistic connection between plant-based shamanism and an enlightened society seem terribly naive. The form of transcendence that appears to link directly to ethical behavior and human well-being is that which occurs in the midst of ordinary waking life. It is by ceasing to cling to the contents of consciousness, to our thoughts, moods, and desires, that we make progress. This project does not in principle require that we experience more content. The freedom from self that is both the goal and the foundation of spiritual life is coincident with normal perception and cognition, though, as I've already said, this can be difficult to realize. The power of psychedelics, however, is that they often reveal, in the span of a few hours, depths of awe and understanding that can otherwise elude us for a lifetime. William James said it about as well as anyone. One conclusion was forced upon my mind at that time, and my impression of its truth has ever since remained unshaken. It is that our normal waking consciousness, rational consciousness as we call it, is but one special type of consciousness. Whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and at a touch they are there in all their completeness, definite types of mentality, which probably somewhere have their field of application and adaptation. No account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness quite disregarded. How to regard them is the question, for they are so discontinuous with ordinary consciousness. Yet they may determine attitudes though they cannot furnish formulas, and open a region though they fail to give a map. At any rate, they forbid a premature closing of our accounts with reality. I believe that psychedelics may be indispensable for some people, especially those who, like me, initially needed convincing that profound changes in consciousness are possible. After that, it seems wise to find ways of practicing that do not present the same risks. Happily, such methods are widely available. This chapter has taken us along the edge of a precipice. There is no question that novel and intense experiences, whether had in the company of a guru, on the threshold of death, or by recourse to certain drugs, can send one spinning into delusion. But they can also broaden one's view. The aims of spirituality are not exactly those of science, but neither are they unscientific. Search your mind, or pay attention to the conversations you have with other people, and you will discover that there are no real boundaries between science and any other discipline that attempts to make valid claims about the world on the basis of evidence and logic. When such claims and their methods of verification admit of experiment and or mathematical description, we tend to say that our concerns are scientific. When they relate to matters more abstract, or to the consistency of our thinking itself, we often say that we are being philosophical. When we merely want to know how people behaved in the past, we dub our interests historical or journalistic. And when a person's commitment to evidence and logic grows dangerously thin, or simply snaps under the burden of fear, wishful thinking, tribalism, or ecstasy, we recognize that he is being religious. The boundaries between true intellectual disciplines are currently enforced by little more than university budgets and architecture. Is the Shroud of Turin a medieval forgery? This is a question of history, of course, and of archaeology, but the techniques of radiocarbon dating make it a question of chemistry and physics as well. The real distinction we should care about, the observation of which is the sine qua non of the scientific attitude, is between demanding good reasons for what one believes and being satisfied with bad ones. Spirituality requires the same commitment to intellectual honesty. Once one recognizes the selflessness of consciousness, the practice of meditation becomes just a means of getting more familiar with it. The goal thereafter is to cease to overlook what is already the case. Paradoxically, this still requires discipline, and setting aside time for meditation is indispensable. But the true discipline is to remain committed throughout the whole of one's life to waking up from the dream of the self. We need not take anything on faith to do this. In fact, the only alternative is to remain confused about the nature of our minds. Consciousness is the basis of both the examined and the unexamined life. It is all that can be seen, and that which does the seeing. No matter how far you have traveled from the place of your birth, and however much you now understand about the world, you have been exploring consciousness and its changes. Why not do so directly? Conclusion. Sometime around her third birthday, my daughter asked, "Where does gravity come from?" After talking about how objects attract each other and wisely ignoring the curvature of space-time, my wife and I arrived at our deepest and most honest answer. We don't know. Gravity is a mystery. People are still trying to figure it out. This type of answer continues to divide humanity. We could have said, as billions of people would have, gravity comes from God. But this would have merely stifled our daughter's intelligence and taught her to stifle it. We could have told her, gravity might be God's way of dragging people to hell, where they burn in fire, and you will burn there forever if you doubt that God exists. No Christian or Muslim can offer a compelling reason why we shouldn't have said such a thing, or the moral equivalent. And yet that would have been nothing less than the emotional and intellectual abuse of a child. I have now heard from many thousands of people who were oppressed in this way, from the moment they could speak, by the terrifying ignorance and fanaticism of their parents. The reason for this widespread mistreatment of children is clear. Most people still believe that religion provides something essential that cannot be had any other way. 12 years have now passed since I first realized how high the stakes are in this war of ideas. I remember feeling the jolt of history when the second plane crashed into the World Trade Center. For many of us, that was the moment we understood that things can go terribly wrong in our world. Not because life is unfair or moral progress impossible, but because we have failed, generation after generation, to abolish the delusions and animosities of our ignorant ancestors. The worst ideas continue to thrive and are still imparted in their purest form to children. What is the meaning of life? What is our purpose on earth? These are some of the great false questions of religion. We need not answer them, for they are badly posed, but we can live our answers all the same. At a minimum, we can create the conditions for human flourishing in this life, the only life of which any of us can be certain. That means we should not terrify our children with thoughts of hell, or poison them with hatred for infidels. We should not teach our sons to consider women their future property, or convince our daughters that they are property even now. And we must decline to tell our children that human history began with bloody magic and will end with bloody magic in a glorious war between the righteous and the rest. Such sins against reason and compassion do not represent the totality of religion, but they lie at its core. As for the rest, charity, community, ritual, and the contemplative life, we need not take anything on faith to embrace these goods. It is one of the most damaging lies of religion, whether liberal, moderate, or extreme, to insist that we must. Spirituality remains the great hole in secularism, humanism, rationalism, atheism, and all the other defensive postures that reasonable men and women strike in the presence of unreasonable faith. People on both sides of this divide imagine that visionary experience has no place within the context of science. Until we can talk about spirituality in rational terms, acknowledging the validity of self-transcendence, our world will remain shattered by dogmatism. This book has been my attempt to begin such a conversation. There is experience, and then there are the stories we tell about it. At its best, religion is a set of stories that recount the ethical and contemplative insights of our wisest ancestors. But these stories come to us bundled with ancient confusion and perennial lies, and they invariably harden into doctrines that defy revision generation after generation. The great pressure of accumulating knowledge in science, medicine, history, has begun to scour our culture of many of these ideas, with the force of a glacier, perhaps, but at a similar pace. The exponential increase in the power of technology brings with it a commensurate increase in the consequences of human ignorance. We do not have centuries to wait for our neighbors to come to their senses. Religious stories may bring meaning to people's lives, but some meanings are patently false and divisive. What does a spiritual experience mean? If you are a Christian sitting in church, it might mean that Jesus Christ survived his death and has taken a personal interest in the fate of your soul. If you are a Hindu praying to Shiva, you will have a very different story to tell. Altered states of consciousness are empirical facts, and human beings experience them under a wide range of conditions. To understand this, and to seek to live a spiritual life without deluding ourselves, we must view these experiences in universal and secular terms. Happiness and suffering, however extreme, are mental events. The mind depends upon the body, and the body upon the world, but everything good or bad that happens in your life must appear in consciousness to matter. This fact offers ample opportunity to make the best of bad situations. Changing your perception of the world is often as good as changing the world. But it also allows a person to be miserable even when all the material and social conditions for happiness have been met. During the normal course of events, your mind will determine the quality of your life. Of course, the mind is as contingent as the body, and the limits of the body are obvious. I am precisely as tall as I am, and not an inch taller. I can jump as high as I can, and no higher. I can't see what is behind my head. My knee hurts. The boundaries of my mind are just as clear. I cannot speak a word of Korean. I don't remember what I did on this date in 2011, or the last words I read of Dante, or even the first words I spoke to my wife this morning. Although I can alter my mood and states of attention, I can do so only within a narrow range. If I am tired, I can open my eyes a little wider and try to perk myself up, but I cannot completely banish the feeling of fatigue. If I am slightly depressed, I can brighten my mood with happy thoughts. I can even access the feeling of happiness directly by simply recalling what it is like to be happy, deliberately putting a smile in my mind. But I cannot reproduce the greatest joy I've ever felt. Everything about my mind and body seems to feel the weight of the past. I am just as I am. But consciousness is different. It appears to have no form at all, because anything that would give it form must arise within the field of consciousness. Consciousness is simply the light by which the contours of mind and body are known. It is that which is aware of feelings such as joy, regret, amusement, and despair. It can seem to take their shape for a time, but it is possible to recognize that it never quite does. In fact, we can directly experience that consciousness is never improved or harmed by what it knows. Making this discovery, again and again, is the basis of spiritual life. As we have seen, there is no compelling reason to believe that the mind is independent of the brain, and yet the deflationary attitude toward consciousness taken by many scientists, wherein reality is considered only from the outside, in third-person terms, is also unwarranted. A middle path exists between making religion out of spiritual life and having no spiritual life at all. We have long known that how things seem in the world can be misleading, and this is no less true of the mind itself. And yet many people have found that through sustained introspection, how things seem can be brought into closer register with how they are. In one sense, the science that underlies this claim is in its infancy, but in another, it is complete. Although we are only beginning to understand the human mind at the level of the brain, and we know nothing about how consciousness itself comes into being, it isn't too soon to say that the conventional self is an illusion. There's no place for a soul inside your head. Consciousness itself is divisible, as we saw in the case of split-brain patients. And even in an intact brain, consciousness is blind to most of what the mind is doing. Everything we take ourselves to be at the level of our subjectivity, our memories and emotions, our capacity for language, the very thoughts and impulses that give rise to our behavior, depends upon distinct processes that are spread out over the whole of the brain. Many of these can be independently interrupted or extinguished. The sense, therefore, that we are unified subjects, the unchanging thinkers of thoughts, and experiencers of experience, is an illusion. The conventional self is a transitory appearance among transitory appearances, and it vanishes when looked for. We need not await any data from the lab to say that self-transcendence is possible, and we need not become masters of meditation to realize its benefits. It is within our capacity to recognize the nature of thoughts, to awaken from the dream of being merely ourselves, and in this way to become better able to contribute to the well-being of others. Spirituality begins with a reverence for the ordinary that can lead us to insights and experiences that are anything but ordinary. And the conventional opposition between humility and hubris has no place here. Yes, the cosmos is vast and appears indifferent to our mortal schemes, but every present moment of consciousness is profound. In subjective terms, each of us is identical to the very principle that brings value to the universe. Experiencing this directly, not merely thinking about it, is the true beginning of spiritual life. We are always and everywhere in the presence of reality. Indeed, the human mind is the most complex and subtle expression of reality we have thus far encountered. This should grant profundity to the humble project of noticing what it is like to be you in the present. However numerous your faults, something in you at this moment is pristine, and only you can recognize it. Open your eyes and see.
Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion was written and read by Sam Harris. It was recorded at Margarita Mix in Santa Monica by Sean Melia and Mike Merzen. Editing and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Madeline Mabee. Waking Up was produced and directed by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion is available in print from Free Press. Other Sam Harris titles from Simon & Schuster Audio are Free Will and the Moral Landscape, read by the author, and End of Faith, read by Brian Emerson.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.